It was Dr. Adkins who found Peter outside the intensive care unit, on his knees. Found was the wrong word, perhaps. He almost tripped over him. Unfazed, the surgeon looked down at Peter's body, assessing in a couple of seconds whether any part of it was in urgent need of medical intervention. "You okay?" he said. "I'm trying to pray," Peter said.
"Oh, okay,"
said Adkins, glancing over Peter's shoulder to a place further down the corridor, as if to say, "Could you try it somewhere where people won't break their neck over you?" "I've come to see Jesus Lover 5, said Peter, hauling himself off the floor. "You know about her?"
"Of course. She's my patient."
The doctor smiled. It's nice to have a real patient for a change, instead of a 5-minute wham-bam thank you man with someone who's got conjunctivitis or hit their thumb with a hammer. Peter stared into the doctor's face, searching for evidence of empathy. I got the impression Dr. Austin didn't really understand what's happening to Lover 5. I got the impression he's assuming you can make her better.
"We'll do what we can," said Adkins inscrutably.
"She's going to die," said Peter.
"Let's not go there yet."
Peter clenched one hand inside the other and found that his strenuous attempts to pray had bruised the tender flesh between his knuckles.
"These people don't heal, you understand that?" he said. "They can't heal. Our bodies, your body, my body, we're living inside a miracle. Forget religion, we're a miracle of nature. We can hit our thumb with a hammer, we can tear a hole in our skin, we can get burnt, broken, swollen up with pus, and a little while later it's all fixed. Good as new. Unbelievable. Impossible. But true. That's the gift we're given. But the Shishkoda, the Oasens, they never received this amazing gift. They get one chance, just one chance, the body they're born with. They do their best to take care of it, but when it gets damaged, that's it.
Dr. Adkins nodded. He was a kindly man, and not unintelligent. He laid a palm on Peter's shoulder.
"Let's take it day by day with this lady. She'll lose her hand, that's obvious. Beyond that, we'll try our best to figure something out."
Peter's eyes stung with tears. He wanted so much to believe.
"Listen," said Adkins. "Remember when I was patching you up, I told you that medicine is just carpentry, plumbing and sewing. Which doesn't apply in this lady's case, I appreciate that. But I forgot to mention, there's chemistry too. These people take painkillers, they take cortisone, they take lots of other medicines from us. They wouldn't take them year after year if nothing had any effect."
Peter nodded, or tried to. It was more of a facial tremor, a shiver of the chin. The cynicism he thought he'd banished forever was coursing through his system. "Placebo. All is placebo. Swallow the pills and feel invigorated while the cells die inside you. Hallelujah. I can walk on these septic feet. The pain is gone. Barely there. Quite bearable. Praise the Lord." Adkins looked down at the palm that he'd laid on Peter's shoulder a minute ago, briefly appraised that palm as if there was a vial of magic serum nestling in it.
"This Lover 5 of yours, she's our way in. We never had one of these people to study before. We'll learn a lot, and we'll learn fast. Who knows? We may be able to save her. Or if we can't save her, we may be able to save her children." He paused. "They do have children, don't they?"
Peter's mind replayed the vision of the calf-like newborn, the cheering crowd, the dressing ceremony, the eerie beauty of little Ikwakuku, clumsily dancing on his inaugural day of life, waving his tiny gloved hands.
"Yes, they do," he said. "Well, there you go," said Adkins.
Lover 5, confined to bed in her brightly lit chamber of care, looked just as small and alone as before. If only there could have been a U-sick worker laid up with a broken leg in one of the other beds, or a few healthy Shishkoda sitting nearby, conversing with her in their native tongue. It would have been less awful. Awful for who, though?
Peter knew it was for his own sake as well as for hers that he yearned for the pathos to be less sharp. In his career as a minister, he'd visited many hospital wards, but never until now to confront a person whose impending death he felt responsible for.
God bless our reunion, Father Peter,
she said as he walked in. Since he'd last seen her, she'd gotten hold of a Usyk bath towel and deftly folded it around her head as an improvised hood. It lent her a more feminine appearance, like a hijab or a wig. She tucked the loose ends under the neckline of her hospital gown and pulled the blankets up to her armpits. Her left hand was still naked. Her right was snugly bound in its cotton sheath.
Love of five. I'm so, so sorry, he said,
his voice already cracking.
Sorry, not necessary,
she reassured him. The absolution cost her an absurd amount of effort to pronounce. Insult to injury. The painting that fell on your hand, he said, lowering himself onto the edge of the bed near the meager hump of her knees. If I hadn't asked for... With her free hand, she did a surprising thing, a thing he'd never have imagined anyone of her kind doing. She silenced him by laying her fingers against his lips. It was the first time he had been touched by the naked flesh of a shishchoda, unmediated by the soft fabric of gloves. Her fingertips were smooth and warm and smelled like fruit.
Nothing fall if God have no plan for the falling.
Gently he enclosed her hand in his. I shouldn't say this, he said, but out of all of your people, you're the one I care about the most.
I know,
she said, with barely a heartbeat's hesitation.
But God have no favorites. God care for all alike.
Her constant allusions to God poked a spear into his soul. He had big confessions to make. Confessions about his faith. Confessions about what he intended to do next. Love of five, he began. I don't want to lie to you. She nodded slowly and emphatically to signal that he need not complete the
thought. You feel in lack of God. You feel you can be no farther anymore.
She turned aside, looked at the doorway through which he had come, the doorway that led to the outside world. Somewhere in that direction was the settlement where she'd first accepted Jesus into her heart. The settlement that now lay empty and abandoned.
Father Kurtzberg also came through this feeling,
she said.
Father Kurzberg became angry, spoke in a loud voice, said, I am no father now. Find another father.
Peter swallowed hard. The Bible booklet he'd sewn lay curled up on the blanket near his useless arse. Back in his quarters, there were so many balls of brightly coloured wool still waiting to be used.
You are,
said Love of Five, and paused to find the right word.
Man. Only man. God is more big than you. You carry the word of God for a while. Then the word becomes too heavy, heavy to carry, and you must rest.
She laid her hand on his thigh.
I understand.
My wife, he began.
I understand,
she repeated.
God join you and your wife together. Now you are unjoined.
In a flash, Peter recalled his wedding day. The light through the church windows, the cake, the knife, Bee's dress. Sentimental daydreams, as irreclaimably lost as a bug-eaten scout uniform tossed in a bin and taken away by garbage men. He forced himself to think instead of his own house as it was now, surrounded by filth and debris. The interior plunged into darkness, and, half hidden in those haunted shadows, the shape of a woman he couldn't recognize. It's not just that we're apart, he said. Bee's in trouble. She needs help. Lover Five nodded. Her bandaged hand screamed louder than any words of recrimination that there could be no trouble more serious than the trouble she was in.
So,
she confirmed,
you will fulfill the word of Jesus. Look, you will leave the 99 in the wilderness and look for the one who is lost.
He felt his face redden as the parable found its mark. She must have learned it from Kurtzberg. I've talked to the doctors, he said wretchedly. They're going to try their best for you and for the others. They won't be able to save your hand, but they might be able to save your life.
I am happy,
she said.
If saved.
He shifted uncomfortably on his perch at the edge of her bed. His left buttock was going numb, and his back was getting sore. In a few minutes from now, he would be out of this room, and his body would revert to normal. Restoring normal blood circulation, pacifying disturbed neurological activity, soothing overextended muscles, while she was left here to contemplate the rotting of her flesh. Is there anything I can do for you right now? He said. She thought for a few seconds.
Sing,
she said.
Sing only with me.
Sing what?
A song of welcome for Father Peter,
she said.
You will go away, I know. Then I hope you will come back in the sweet by and by. And when you come back, we will sing again the same song.
Without further prelude, she began.
Amazing grace.
He joined in at once. His voice, hoarse and muted in speech, found strength when called upon to sing. The acoustics in the intensive care unit were actually better than in his church, where the humid atmosphere and the throng of bodies always dampen the sound. Here, in this chilly concrete cavity, with only empty beds, dormant machinery, and metal IV stands for company, Amazing Grace reverberated rich and clear.
"Was blind," he chanted. "But now I see."
The length of her breaths, even though she shortened them for his sake, made the song last a very long time. He was exhausted by the end.
"Thank you,"
said Lover Five.
"You will go now. I will remain always." your brother.
There was no message from B. She was finished with him. She'd given up. Or maybe she had committed suicide. The state of the world, the loss of Joshua, the loss of her faith, the rift in their marriage, these were terrible griefs to bear. And maybe she just hadn't been able to bear them. As a teenager, she'd been suicidal. He'd almost lost her then, without even knowing she was there to lose. He opened a fresh page on the chute. He must trust that she was still alive, still able to receive his messages. The blank screen loomed so large. So much blankness to envelop whatever meaning he might attempt to put there. He thought of quoting or paraphrasing the bit in 2 Corinthians 5 about the house not made with hands that awaits us if our earthly home is destroyed. Sure, it was a Bible quote, but maybe it was relevant in a non-religious context, like BG tapping his own chest to indicate that home wasn't bricks and mortar. Home could be anywhere. A voice came to him and said, "Don't be stupid." "I'm coming home," he wrote. And that was all. Having promised that he would return, he was aware that he had no idea how to make it happen. He clicked on the green scarab icon, and the chute revealed the 3 paltry options on his menu: maintenance, repairs, admin, and Granger. None of them seemed quite right. He clicked on admin and wrote, "I'm sorry, but I need to go home. As soon as possible. I don't know if I'll be able to come back sometime in the future. If so, it would need to be with my wife. I'm not trying to blackmail you. I'm just saying that's the only way I could do it. Please respond and confirm when I can go. Sincerely, Peter Lee, Pastor." He reread what he had written, deleted everything from "I don't know" to "the only way I could do it." Too many words, too much explanation. The essential message, the one which demanded action, was simpler than that. He stood up, stretched. A sharp sting on his leg reminded him of the injury there. The wound was healing well, but the flesh was tight along the suture line. He would always have a scar, and it would occasionally hurt. There were limits to what the miraculous human organism could repair. His dishdasher, hanging on the washing line, was dry now. The blurry marks of the ink crucifix had been almost obliterated, faded to the palest lilac. The hems were so badly frayed, they looked as if they'd been deliberately manufactured that way, as a fluffy frill. "You don't think it's too girly, do you?" he recalled B saying, when they first took the garment out of its shrink wrap. Not only did he recall the words, but also the sound of B's voice, the expression in her eyes, the light on the side of her nose, everything. And she'd said, "You can be naked underneath, if you want." She was his wife. He loved her. Surely somewhere in the universe, allowing for the laws of time and space and relativity, there must be a place where that could still be possible. "Imagine you're in a tiny inflatable dinghy lost at sea," Ella Reinman had suggested to him during those endless interviews on the 10th floor of the Swanky Hotel. "Far in the distance, there's a ship. You can't tell whether it's moving towards you or away. You know that if you try to stand up and wave, the dinghy will capsize. But if you sit still, nobody will see you and you won't get rescued. What do you do?"
"Sit tight."
"Are you sure? What if the ship is definitely moving away?"
"I'd have to live with that."
"You'd just sit and watch it go."
"I pray to God."
"What if there was no answer?"
"There's always an answer."
His calmness had impressed them. His refusal to embrace wild, impulsive gestures had helped him make the grade. It was the calmness of the homeless, the calmness of the Shish Choda. Without knowing it, he'd always been an honorary alien. Now, he was pacing his quarters in a frenzy, an animal trapped in a cage. He needed to be home. Get going, get going, get going. The needle in the vein. The woman saying, "This will sting some, then blackness." Yes, Come on. Every minute of delay was a torment. Pacing around, he almost tripped on a discarded shoe, seized hold of it, hurled it across the room. Maybe Granger in her quarters was doing the same. Maybe they should go berserk together, share the bourbon. He really wanted a drink. He checked the chute. Nothing. Who was supposed to read his message anyway? Some off-duty engineer or kitchen hand? What kind of fucking system was this, where there was no one in charge, no one with an office you could barge into, no one you could grab by the shirt? He paced his quarters some more, breathing too heavily. The floor, the ceiling, the window, the furniture, the bed, it was all wrong, wrong, wrong. He thought of Tusker, delivering his Légion étrangère spiel. All that stuff about the weaklings who'd gone crazy, climbing the walls, begging to go home. He could still taste Tusker's sarcasm, smug bastard. 18 minutes later on his chute, there was an answer from admin.
Howdy. Forwarded your request to USIC HQ. Typical response time lag is 24 hours. Even big shots got to sleep sometimes. But I predict they will say yes. Diplomacy-wise, it might have been good to make some noises about coming back to finish your mission. But hey, it's not my business to tell you how to win friends and influence people. I wasn't scheduled to do my next flight for another month, but what the heck, I'll make the best of it. Maybe get some new tennis shoes. Buy an ice cream. Visit a steakhouse. Or a whorehouse. Just kidding. I'm a fine upstanding pilgrim. You know me. Stand by, and I'll give you the word when it's time to go. Au revoir, Tusker.
As soon as Peter finished reading these words, he leapt up, knocking his chair over, and jumped exultant into the air, clenching his fists like a sportsman granted victory against the odds. He would have yelled hallelujah, too, if it hadn't been for the searing spasm that shot through his injured leg. Crying in pain, laughing in relief, he fell to the floor, curled up like a bug or a thief who'd broken his ankles, or a husband who was clutching his wife's flesh rather than his own.
Thank you, he breathed. Thank you.
But who was he thanking? He didn't know. He only knew that thanks were due.
Chapter 27. Stay Where You Are. His name was Peter Lee, son of James Lee and Kate Lee, nay Wilfolk, grandson of George and June. He was born in Horns Mill, Hertford, Hertfordshire. The names of his cats, in the order that he'd owned them, were Mocky, Silky, Cleo, Sam, Titus, and Joshua. When he returned home, he would have another cat from an animal refuge, if such places still existed when he got back. As for his own child, he would call him or her whatever name B wanted. Or maybe Kate. They would discuss it when the time came. Maybe they'd wait until the baby was born and see what its personality was. People were individuals from day one. He stood as straight as he could in his soul-destroying room in the USIC base and appraised himself in the mirror. He was a 33-year-old English male, deeply tanned as if he'd been on a long holiday to Alicante or some such Mediterranean resort. But he did not look fit. His chin and collarbones were worryingly sharp, sculpted by inadequate diet. He was too thin for the dish dasher, although he looked even worse in Western clothes. There were a few small scars on his face, some of them dating from his alcoholic years, some more recent and delineated with neat crusts. His eyes were bloodshot, and there was fear and grief in them.
"You know what would sort you out?"
a fellow dosser once said to him as they stood in the rain waiting for a homeless shelter to open.
A wife.
When Peter asked him if he spoke from experience, the old wino only smiled and shook his grizzled head. The USIC corridors that had once seemed like a maze were now familiar, too familiar. The familiarity of a prison. The framed posters hung in their appointed places, marking his progress through the base. As he walked toward the vehicle bay, the glazen images gazed sightlessly down at him. Rudolph Valentino, Rosie the Riveter, the dog in the basket with the ducks, the smiling picnickers by Renoir. Laurel and Hardy caught frozen, stoic, forever interrupted in their hopeless attempt to build a house.
and those 1930s construction workers suspended high above New York. They would be suspended there eternally, never finishing their lunch, never falling off their girder, never growing old. He pushed through the last door and was greeted by the smell of engine grease. For his farewell visit to the Shishchoda, he wanted to travel to C2 himself, alone, not as a passenger in someone else's car. He cast his eyes over the vehicle bay in search of the person who was manning it today, hoping it might be someone he'd never met before, someone who knew nothing about him, except that he was the VIP missionary man who should be given whatever he asked for, within reason. But the person bending into the engine of a Jeep, canopied by the open hood, had a rump he recognized. It was Craig again. "Hi," he said, knowing even as he opened his mouth that oratory would get him nowhere. "Hi," she said, only half acknowledging him, as she continued to slather the engine innards with lubricant. The negotiation was short and sweet. He could hardly blame her for refusing to hand over a vehicle, given what happened last time. Maybe she'd been criticized by her fellow USIC personnel for allowing him, clearly off his head, to drive Kurtzberg's hearse into the night, only to need emergency rescue later, while the vehicle had to be schlepped back to base in a separate trip. Craig was all smiles and casual body language, but the subtext was, "You are a pain in the ass." "There is a drug and food exchange scheduled just a few hours from now," she said as she wiped her hands on a rag. "Why not go along for the ride?" "Because this is goodbye. I'm saying goodbye to the Shishchoda." "Goodbye to the what?" "The Oasens. The native people. The freaks in Freaktown, you fat idiot," he thought. She chewed on this. "You need your own vehicle to say goodbye in?" He hung his head in frustration. "If I'm shoulder to shoulder with USIC personnel, it might look like I was using you guys as, bodyguards. Emotional bodyguards, if you see what I mean." Craig's direct yet unfocused stare told him that no, she didn't see. "It might look like I didn't want to face them on my own." "Okay," said Craig, idly scratching her snake tattoo. Seconds passed, making it obvious that her okay did not mean, "In that case, I will give you a car." It did not even mean, "I understand why that might worry you." It meant, "So be it." "Also," he said, "I'm not sure that Granger will want to be going out to the settlement today."
"Won't be Granger,"
said Craig breezily, and consulted a printed roster.
"Granger is off duty for..."
She flipped pages, scanning for the name.
"The foreseeable,"
she summarized at last, and flipped back to today.
"It'll be Tusca and Flores."
Peter looked over her shoulder at all the greased-up vehicles he could drive out of this place, if only she wasn't in the way.
"Your choice,"
she grinned, and he understood that sometimes there is no choice at all. "I see you standing on the shore of a huge lake," Bea had said the last time he'd held her in his arms. "It's night, and the sky is full of stars." And she had shared her vision of him preaching to a multitude of unseen creatures in fishing boats, bobbing on the sea. Perhaps they'd both known that it was a dream, that nothing like that would really happen. It was another sunny, torpid day on Oasis, and the natives were dozing in their cots, or making food for their foreign guests, or washing clothes, or spending time with their children, hoping that their flesh would survive unharmed until the sun set and they were cocooned in their cots again. Maybe they were praying. Filling in time before the appointed hour for his ride, Peter considered what, if anything, to take with him to the settlement. A stack of half-finished booklets lay on the table, next to some balls of wool. He picked up the nearest, a paraphrase of Revelation chapter 21. He'd reduced the number of S sounds to 4 and gotten rid of all the T's. That was probably as much as he could achieve. "And there I found a new heaven and a new earth, for the heaven and the earth from before were gone. And I heard a loud voice from heaven declaring, 'Behold, God will dwell with you, and you will be his very own people. and God will be your very own God. And there will be no more death, no more sorrow, no more pain. And God upon the throne said, Behold, I make everything new. To avoid the need for explanations that might go nowhere, he'd omitted Jerusalem, the sea, the tabernacle, the apostle John, the bride and the husband, men, and a few other things. The God of this pamphlet no longer wiped tears from eyes, partly because those words were too difficult to pronounce, partly because, after all this time, it was still a mystery whether the Shishchoda had eyes or wept. Peter reconnected with how long he'd sweated to think of an alternative word for true. All that labor. And for what? The only words he had to offer them now were sorry and goodbye.
Beautiful day, said Tusker, and it was. The atmosphere was putting on a show for them, as if in honor of a momentous occasion. Two huge columns of unfallen rain, one to the west and the other to the east, had drifted toward each other, and were now mingling in their topmost reaches, forming a glistering arch in the sky. It was a long way off yet, miles probably, but it conjured the illusion that they were about to pass under a colossal portal made of nothing more substantial than water droplets.
Gotta admit, said Tusker, view-wise, that's a 9 out of 10.
Rear windows are shut, I hope, said Flores. Don't want those drugs to get rained on.
Yes, they're shut, said Peter. Tusker and Flores, stationed in the front seats, had barely said a word to him since the jeep had left the compound. He felt like a child stashed in the back, allowed to come along for no better reason than that he couldn't be left unattended, and with nothing to do on the journey, but hope that his parents didn't quarrel. The hermetic seal of air conditioning that Granger tried so diligently to maintain was not Tusker's style. He kept the front windows open as he drove, allowing the air free access to the vehicle's interior. The languid agitations of the atmosphere were joined by an artificial breeze from the speed of the vehicle.
Where's Granger? Asked Peter.
Taking it easy, said Tusker, only his shoulder and driving arm visible to Peter.
Drunk and incapable, said Flores, wholly hidden.
She's been a pretty good pharmacist all these years, said Tusker.
There are other pharmacists,
Flores remarked.
Well, let's see what Santa Claus brings, shall we? Said Tusker, and Flores shut up.
The brilliant arch in the sky had drawn no nearer, so Peter looked out the passenger window instead. The landscape, which he'd grown to love, was still austerely beautiful, but today he saw its simplicity through different eyes, and it disturbed him. He could imagine a farm girl like Granger scanning the terrain's serene emptiness, searching in vain for wildlife, plant life, or any kind of life, to remind her of her childhood habitat.
Granger needs to go home, he said,
the words springing out of his mouth before he even knew he'd formed them.
Yeah, said Tusker. I think she does.
Soon, said Peter, and recalled for the first time in years that soon was the name of a scripture pamphlet he and B had produced ages ago for the Jesus lovers of Arunachal Pradesh. In a flash, in his mind's eye, he saw his hands and B's moving near each other on the kitchen table, his hands folding the pamphlet in three, with the soon letterhead facing out, B's hand slipping the paper into an envelope, sealing it, addressing it to some mountain-dwelling Adivasi with an unpronounceable name. Cardboard boxes full of soon pamphlets had been sent overseas at 6 monthly intervals, an absurd expense in the electronic age. But not everybody in the world had a computer, and besides, there was something special about holding Bible verses in your hand. How long ago it was, his hand holding a pamphlet called Soon, reaching across the table to B's hand.
I forwarded her request too, Tusker was saying. My guess is you'll both go together.
He yawned.
Two simultaneous bailouts from our little paradise. Do you guys know something I don't? On second thought, don't tell me.
There's nothing wrong with this place, said Peter, staring out the window again. I'm sorry to let everybody down.
Some people can take it, some can't, said Tusker lightly.
Can't reuse an EPFCG.
Sorry?
Explosively pumped flux compression generator.
Those words, which to Peter were as weird and incomprehensible as any arcane scripture would be to his hosts, were the last spoken for a long while. The illusion that they were about to pass under a vast, twinkling archway faded gradually, as the two columns of water drifted apart and morphed into different, unsymmetrical shapes. Rain splattered against the windscreen and roof, its rhythm strange as ever, determined by physics beyond human understanding. Then the shower passed, and the windscreen wipers squeaked annoyingly against clear glass, before Tusker switched them off. The caramel facades of Freaktown were only a few hundred meters away now, and Peter could already make out a tiny figure standing in the appointed spot.
When we arrive, he piped up from the back, I just need a minute. 2 minutes alone with that person.
Okay, said Tusker, changing gear for the final stretch. But no tongues.
Jesus Lover 1 was waiting in front of the building with the white star painted on it. When he caught sight of Peter, his body jerked in surprise. But he managed to compose himself in the few seconds that elapsed between the revelation and Peter's deposition from the jeep.
You are alive,
he said.
I hope so, Peter said, and regretted it at once. The Shishkoda didn't do flippancy, and the quip only made it harder for Lover One to adjust to Peter's miraculous recovery from his mortal wounds.
All the others believe you are dead, said Lover One. I believe you are alive. I alone have faith.
Peter struggled to think of the appropriate response to that. An affectionate embrace was out. Thank you, he said. Behind the bead curtains in the doorways of the buildings, shadowy figures had gathered.
Grigor's gone on,
called a voice. Peter knew enough of the language to know that this meant the task is still asleep. Or to paraphrase, get on with it. Lover One roused himself from his trance and accepted his official role. He turned toward the vehicle in anticipation of greeting the Usyk envoy, the scarf-wearing woman Granger, who abhorred him and all his kind. Nurse Flores stepped out of the vehicle. As she approached the Oasen, it was evident that there was not much difference between them in size. By chance, their garments, her uniform, his robes, were almost the same color. Lover One was visibly thrown by these unexpected parodies. He appraised Flores quite a few seconds longer than politeness allowed, but she stared right back.
You and I,
said Lover One.
Never before now.
And he reached forward and touched her gently on the wrist with his gloved fingertips.
He means, hi, I haven't met you before, explained Peter.
Glad to meet you, said Flores.
While that may have been an overstatement, she seemed quite free of Granger's unease.
You bring medicine,
said Lover One.
Of course, said Flores,
and went to the rear of the vehicle to fetch it. Several other Oasens ventured out from hiding, then several more. That was unusual. Two or three had been the maximum in Peter's experience. Flores carried the box in her sinewy arms. It looked bigger and fuller than last time, perhaps because she was smaller than Granger. Still, she wielded it without effort and handed it to one of the Oasens with smooth confidence.
To whom shall I address the explanations? She said.
I understand more,
said Jesus Lover One.
To you then, said Flores, in a friendly but businesslike manner.
The box, as always, was crammed with a mixture of branded and unbranded medicines. Flores extracted each little plastic bottle,
cardboard packet and tube, held it aloft like an auction hammer while describing its function, and slotted it back into place.
"I'm not a pharmacist," she said, "but it's all written on the labels and the leaflets anyway. The main thing is for you to tell us what's working and not working. Pardon me saying so, but there's been too much mystery here. Let's take the mystery out of it. Try more of a scientific approach. Think you can do that?"
Lover One was silent for a few seconds, just focusing on the creature standing head to head with him.
"We are grateful for medicine,"
he said at last. "That's nice," said Flores flatly.
"But listen, this here is a packet of sumicin. It's an antibiotic. If you get an infection in your waterworks or your guts, it could fix you. But if you've taken a lot of sumicin in the past, it might not work so well. You might be better taking this one here, amoxicillin. These two packets of amoxicillin are generics."
"Name from where all other name come,"
said Jesus Lover One.
"That's right. Now, amoxicillin is fine if you've never had it before, but if your body has become resistant to it, you're better with this purple one here, Augmentin, which has some extra stuff in it to overcome that resistance."
Flores put the Augmentin back in the box and scratched her nose with a simian finger.
"Listen, we could stand here all day talking about the pros and cons of each and every antibiotic in this box. But what we really need is to match up specific drugs with specific problems. For example, take you. Are you sick?"
"Thank God, no,"
said Lover One.
"Well, bring out someone who is sick and let's talk."
There was a pause.
"We are grateful for medicine,"
said Lover One.
"We have food for you."
The tone was neutral, and yet there was stubbornness, even threat in it.
"Great, thanks. We'll get around to that in a minute," said Flores, unswayed. "But first, can I meet someone who thinks they need antibiotics? As I said, I'm not a pharmacist. I'm not a doctor. I would just prefer to get a little better acquainted with you folks."
As the two of them stood their ground, more Oasens ventured out from shelter. Peter realized that they must always have been there in the past, whenever these handovers were done, but had lacked the courage to emerge into view. What was it about Flores? Her smell, perhaps? Peter turned to Tusker. Tusker winked.
"Obey the mighty Flores," he said wryly. "Or else."
Once it had become clear that the handover was going to take some time, Peter excused himself and began to walk across the tundra to his church. It was quite a windy day, and his dishdasha flapped around his ankles, but the breeze was useful in reducing the humidity, promoting the illusion of fresher oxygen. Inside his sandals, his feet were already slippery with sweat. He looked down at them as he walked and recalled the sensation of stepping into crisp snow with thick-soled boots on a raw January morning in Richmond Park, with his newly divorced father smoking a cigarette nearby. No sooner had he glimpsed the image than it was gone. Every now and then, as he crossed the plain to the temple that he and his flock had built, he looked over his shoulder in case Lover One was following. But Lover One was not following, and Peter's view of the tiny figures near the Usyk vehicle grew indistinct through the blur of interlapping air currents. When he reached his church, he extended his palms and swung open the doors, expecting to find the place empty. But no, there were 50 or 60 brightly colored souls gathered inside, already seated in the pews, as if by firm prearrangement. Not the full congregation, but a healthy turnout, especially considering they'd gathered to worship on their own with no pastor.
Quite a few of them had been working in the white flower fields on the day of his downfall, and had witnessed the piercing of his flesh, had watched the vermin's teeth mutilate him so badly that there could be no hope of survival, even with the technique of Jesus. Maybe this gathering was a memorial service for Father Pierre, and here he was, gatecrashing it. A murmur of wonder passed through the crowd. Then a swell of communal elation charged the air, taking up palpable space, pushing against the walls, threatening to lift the ceiling. If he'd wanted to, he could have done anything with them at this moment, taken them anywhere. They were his.
God bless our reunion, Father Peter,
they exclaimed, first one by one, then as a chorus. Each voice aggravated the grief in his chest a little more. Their faith had been buoyed up to the heavens, and he had come to let them down. The doors thudded shut behind him, their well-oiled motion aided by the wind. Plentiful light beamed through the windows, illuminating the hooded heads of the Jesus lovers so that they glowed like candle flames in a votive rack. As he walked between the pews, the surreal montage of paintings on the ceiling hung heavy over him. Lover 12's bright pink Jesus walking hand in hand with the glistening grey Lazarus. Lover 14's blue and yellow nativity. Lover 20's Mary Magdalene spewing forth ectoplasmic devils. Lover 63's Thomas the Doubter. And, of course, Lover 5's painting of the risen Christ and his women, secure in its place, fastened with extra care after the accident that had maimed her. The scarecrow in the loincloth, so different from the kindly mensch of Christian tradition, had suddenly become terrifying. The blaze of light where his head should be, and the eye-shaped holes in his starfish hands, which Peter had once taken as evidence that God could not be confined to the iconography of one race, now struck him as proof of an unbreachable gulf. He took his stand behind the pulpit. He noted that the Shishkhoda had tidied his bed, washed and dried and folded the linen, cleaned the boots that Lover 5 had sewn for him, and placed a mislaid pencil on the pillow where it could be admired as a sacred relic by future generations. Now, blessed with his miraculous return, they sat in rapt attention, Bible booklets at their side, awaiting the call to sing the first hymn, which might, according to custom, be In the Garden, or For God Be the Glory. He cleared his throat. He trusted against hope that inspiration would come from somewhere, as it always had before. He said, Some of the congregation made the shoulder-trembling motions he'd always interpreted as laughter. He hoped it was laughter, elicited by his clumsy pronunciation. But maybe he'd never really known what those motions meant after all. He continued. He could sense their bemusement at his strained and childish speech, so unnecessary when they were only too willing to listen to the holy language of James the King. But he wanted to address them, just once, in a way that they could fully understand. He owed them that much, their dignity at the expense of his own.
That was Jesus, could not but Kratum.
He finished his exact tally of the worshippers, begun as a habitual reflex. 52. He would never know how many more souls were concealed in the settlement. Never know how far away he'd been from bringing the entire community to Christ. He only knew that he recognized each and every person here, and not just by the colors of their robes.
Christ.
he said.
Could have not the kid with us. Forget to wish the work my kiss.
The Book of Strange New Things. He extracted the King James Bible from his bag, and, instead of thumbing the gilt-edged pages to a selected passage for reading aloud, he stepped out from behind the pulpit and carried the book to the Jesus lovers in the front pew. With fastidious gentleness, not because of reverence for the book, but because of concern for the fragile flesh before him, he handed it to Lover 17, who cradled it in her lap. He returned to the pulpit.
Christ asses,
he said.
Caution! God has just a curtain with us. He's freaky, Mr. Quintus.
A thrill of consternation was passing through his flock. Heads tilted, hands agitated. Lover 15 uttered a cry.
Kick a riddle, Grindang, corpse of us, through God. Figure, Kurt Quinn, Korkin again, Kurkin King, with us.
He pressed on.
Catch you, my cock. Christ, feast to kick, I keep them. You quit the ash to get the wish. Jesus, love of
five. His voice broke, and he had to grip the wings of his pulpit to keep himself from trembling.
Jesus, love of five, Corridon, just gone. Christ, quit with that. Christ, with keen, keen.
You sick? He took a deep, shuddering breath. And that was it. He could go no further. The word he needed, the most crucial word, the one he didn't know in the Shishkhoda language. He bowed his head and took refuge, at the last, in his own foreign tongue. Forgive. He left the pulpit, picked up the canary yellow boots, one in each hand, and walked stiffly down the aisle toward the exit. For the first few seconds, which felt like minutes, he walked in silence alone. Then the Jesus lovers rose from their seats and gathered all around him, touching him tenderly on the shoulders, the back, the abdomen, the buttocks, the thighs, anywhere they could reach, while saying in clear, unhampered voices,
"Forgive. Forgive. 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 Forgive."
Each in their turn, until he blundered through the doors into the harsh sunlight. On the way back to the settlement, as his flaccid, empty bag flapped against his waist, he looked around several times at his church, silhouetted against the brilliant sky. No one had emerged from it but him. Belief was a place that people didn't leave until they absolutely must. The Shishkhoda had been keen to follow him to the kingdom of heaven, but they weren't keen to follow him into the valley of doubt. He knew that one day, maybe very soon, they would have another pastor. They'd taken from him what they needed, and their search for salvation would go on when he was long gone. After all, their souls dreamt so ardently of a longer stay in the flesh, a longer spell of consciousness. It was natural. They were only human. Back at the Usyk Jeep, things had moved on. Lover One was nowhere to be seen. The medicines had all been distributed, and the food was being loaded into the vehicle. More Shishkhoda than usual were involved, quite a crowd of them.
Both Tusker and Flores were available to take hold of the tubs, sacks, and tins brought out to them. But Peter noticed, even from a distance, that the Shishchoda approached Flores first and detoured to Tusker only when Flores already had her hands full. He figured it out at last. They liked her. Who would have thought it? They liked her.
"Let me carry that," said Tusker, as Flores took charge of a particularly heavy bag of white flour dough.
"I'm okay," said Flores.
Her hair was plastered with sweat, emphasizing the smallness of her skull, and blue veins stood out on her temples. Her whole torso was sodden. She was having a grand time. A little while later, when the three of them were seated in the vehicle and Tusker was driving away from C2, she said,
"We're going to crack them, Joe."
"Crack them?"
echoed Tusker.
"Find out what makes them tick," she explained.
"Yeah," said Tusker,
clearly not much interested in the prospect.
"Yes, and then, God willing, we'll fix them."
Peter was surprised to hear such words uttered by a USIC employee. But then Flores's face appeared in the gap between the front seats, like a gargoyle head jutting out from a Gothic wall, seeking out the minister stashed in the back.
"Just a figure of speech, you understand," she said. "I really meant with luck."
Her face vanished again, but she wasn't done talking.
"I guess you don't believe there's such a thing as luck, huh?"
Peter turned his face to stare out the window. At the speed Tusker was driving, the dark earth could be mistaken for tarmac, and the occasional outcrop of pale wildflower swept past in a blur like the painted white lines of a motorway. If he imagined hard enough, he might even see M25 road signs estimating the distance to London.
"I hope there is," he answered Flores, a little too late.
He was pretty sure the word luck appeared nowhere in the Bible. But that didn't mean there was no such thing. Granger had called him a lucky guy, and, with B at his side, for the best part of his life, he truly had been. When he got back to his quarters, there was, finally, a message from B. It said,
"Peter, I love you, but please don't come home. I beg you, stay where you are."
Chapter 28. Amen.
"What I like about this place," said Morrow, making brisk progress on her treadmill, "is that every day there's something a little bit different, but also it's the same."
She, BG, and Peter were exercising in the gazebo. It was just another day on Oasis, another scheduled break in the task at hand, a few hours of R&R before work resumed on the great project. The canopy was shading them from the sun, but the light was so intense at this stage of the afternoon that it penetrated the canvas, casting a yellow tinge over their flesh. Morrow had worked up a big sweat already. The fabric of her shalwar was sculpted to her thighs as she paced, and her bare midriff glistened. She had announced 300 steps as her goal and must be about halfway through by now, never letting the rhythm slacken. She swiveled her wrists on the treadmill's handlebars, as if revving the throttle grip of a motorcycle.
"You should try it with just your legs. No holding on," advised BG,
resting between bouts of press-ups.
"Better for your quads, your tibs, everything."
"I see it as exercise for my hands too," said Morrow. "People who lose a finger often let the hand get sloppy. I made a decision. Not me."
Peter was lifting a sandbag on a pulley, or trying to. His arms had become quite strong and wiry from working in the whiteflower fields, but the muscles he'd toughened must be a different set from the ones he was straining now.
"Don't bust a gut on the lifting," advised BG. "The lowering's just as good. Do it slow. Slow as you can."
"It's still too heavy for me, I think," said Peter. "What's the bag filled with? Not sand, surely?"
He couldn't imagine USIC approving the shipment of a sack of sand when, for the same cost-weight ratio, they could transport a sack of sugar or a person.
"Earth," said BG,
gesturing at the bare acres around the exercise yard. He removed his singlet and wrung it out in his fists. An arc of puckered scars came to life near his left armpit, marring the smooth swell of his pectoral.
He put his singlet back on.
"And I suppose we could let some of the soil out," said Peter.
"I don't suppose so, bro," said BG.
His facial expression was unsmilingly serious, but he was amused. Human beings could be read quite easily once you got to know them a bit. It was all in the tone, the cadences, the twinkle in the eyes, so many subtle factors that defied scientific description, but which you could, if you wished, build a lifelong friendship on. Peter tried to lift the sandbag again. This time he barely raised it above knee level before his biceps began to hurt.
"Part of your problem there," said BG, coming over, "is you need more of a balanced approach."
He unhooked the sandbag from the pulley, hoisted it without much effort to his chest, then cradled it in one arm.
"Most important muscle is your brain. You gotta plan what you're gonna do. Warm up to it. Find an exercise that pushes you to the limit, but not beyond it. With a sandbag, I suggest a straight carry."
"Sorry?" BG stood close to Peter, transferred the sack from his own arms into Peter's, carefully, as if it was a sleeping baby.
"Just hug it to your chest," he said. "Wrap your arms around it and walk. From one end of the gazebo to the other, and again, as many times as you can until you can't do it no more. Then lower it to the ground, nice and easy."
Peter did as he was told. BG watched. So did Morrow, who had finished her 300 steps and was drinking from a bottle of pale green liquid, possibly rainwater, possibly a small fortune's worth of carbonated soft drink from a faraway multinational corporation. Peter hurried past them with the sack in his arms, back and forth, back and forth. He performed reasonably well with the carrying part, but when he reached his limit, the lowering part was clumsy.
"I need more practice," he said, panting.
"Well," sighed BG,
"you ain't gonna get it, are you?"
It was the first time he'd alluded to Peter's imminent departure.
"I might," said Peter, sitting down on a low wooden pedestal, whose purpose he couldn't guess. "Nothing to stop me carrying a sandbag when I'm back home. Actually, I might have to if there's a flood. There's been a lot of flooding lately."
"They need to put more thought into their sorry-ass water management systems," BG remarked.
Morrow stood up and smoothed her clothing. Her exercise break was over and duty called.
"Maybe you should do what you have to and then come straight back," she said.
"Not without my wife," said Peter.
"Well, maybe she can come too."
Usyk decided she couldn't, apparently. Morrow shrugged, and a flash of defiance animated her normally passionless face.
"Usyk Shmusyk. What's Usyk anyway? We're Usyk. Us, here. Maybe it's time the eligibility tests got loosened up a little."
"Yeah, they're tough,"
agreed BG in a wistful tone, half proud of himself for having made the grade, half rueful for all the potential brothers and sisters who hadn't made it.
"I have a goddamn needle. That's in the Bible, ain't it?"
Almost as a reflex, Peter girded himself to craft a diplomatic answer, then realized he didn't have to.
"Yes, BG, it is. Matthew, chapter 19, verse 24. "I'll remember that," said BG, then grinned broadly, to signal that he knew very well he wouldn't.
"Husband and wife team," said Morrow, stowing the bottle in her tote bag. "I think that would be kind of romantic."
She spoke in a wistful tone, as though romance was something exotic and strange that might be observed in a tribe of monkeys or snow geese, not in anyone she'd ever known. Peter closed his eyes. B's final message and his reply were imprinted there as clear as any verse of scripture.
"Peter, I love you," she'd written. "But please don't come home, I beg you. Stay where you are. It's safer and I want you safe. This is the last message I'll be able to send you. I'm not going to be able to stay in this house. I will be living with other people, strangers. I don't know where exactly. We'll be moving around. I can't explain, just take it from me that it's best. Nothing here is as it was when you left. Things can change so fast. It's irresponsible for me to bring a baby into this rotten world, but the alternative is killing it, and I just don't have the courage to do that. I expect things will end badly anyway,
and it will be much kinder on you not to be here to see it. If you love me, don't make me watch you suffer. It's funny. All those years ago when we first met, people warned me what a hard and devious exploiter you were, always manipulating people to fall for you. But I know you're just an innocent little kid at heart. This planet's too cruel for you now. I'll take comfort from thinking of you in a safe place, with some chance of a happy life. Beatrice. To which he had replied, without pause for doubt or deliberation, just this. Safe or unsafe, happy or unhappy, my place is by your side. Don't give up. I will find you.
You take care of yourself, okay? Said BG. You're going to a bad place. Stay strong. Keep focused. You promise me that?
Peter smiled. I promise. He and the big man shook hands, formally and decorously, like diplomats. No bear hugs, no high fives. BG knew how to tailor the gesture to the occasion. He turned and walked away, with Morrow at his side. Peter watched their bodies dwindle and disappear into the ugly exterior of the Usyk base. Then he took a seat on a swing, holding the chains loosely, and wept a while. Not big sobs, not even aloud. Nothing that Lover 5 might have called a very long song. Just tears on his cheeks, which got licked up by the atmosphere before they could fall to the earth. Eventually, he walked back to the sandbag and kneeled down next to it. Without much difficulty, he dragged it up his thighs onto his lap. Next, wrapping his arms around it, he hauled it to his chest. It was heavier than B, he supposed, although it was hard to be sure. Lifting a person was easier somehow. It shouldn't be, because both of you are subject to gravity. There was no escaping that. Yet he'd tried lifting an unconscious body, and he'd lifted B, and there was a difference. And a baby. A baby would be lighter still. Much lighter. He sat holding the sandbag until his knees were hurting and arms were sore. When he finally let it slip to the ground, he couldn't guess how long Granger had been standing near him, watching. I thought you were angry with me, he said. So you ran away? She said. I just wanted to give you space, he said. She laughed. I have all the space I can handle. He checked her appearance, unobtrusively, he hoped. She looked sober, dressed as normal, ready for work. You're going home too, right? Right, she said. We'll be together, he said. The reassurance cut no ice with her. We'll be in the same ship, but we won't be aware of it. We'll wake up together at the other end, he said. She looked away. They were heading for different destinations and both knew it. Is there... He began, then got stuck for a few seconds. Is there a part of you that's sorry to leave? She shrugged. They'll get another pharmacist. They'll get another minister. Everyone's replaceable. Yes, and irreplaceable too. The sound of an engine revving distracted them. Not far off, a vehicle had pulled away from the base and was now driving in the general direction of the big brassiere. It was the black station wagon, the one Kurtzberg had always used. Mechanics had fixed it, proving that if you were a car, you could be struck by lightning, pronounced dead, and yet be brought back to life. Not exactly good as new, but saved from the scrap heap by the grace of experts. The rear of the wagon was crammed with pipes of some sort, which stuck out some distance from the hatch and were secured with rope. The bed must have been ditched. Evidently, now that the Usyk personnel knew for certain that the pastor was dead, they no longer felt constrained to keep his car as he liked it, permanently parked in a bay earmarked pastor, but to put it to general use instead. Waste not, want not. And hey, Kurtzberg had even handled his own funeral, instead of causing headaches by dying at the base. What a guy.
Are you still praying for my dad? Said Granger.
I'm having trouble praying for anyone right now, he said, gently removing a bright green insect from his sleeve and launching it into the air. But tell me, how are you going to find him?
I'll figure it out,
she said. I just need to be back. Then I'll know what to do. Are there relatives who could help?
Maybe, she said, in a tone that suggested that maybe, in equal likelihood, a Tibetan football team, a herd of talking buffalo, or a host of angels might pitch in to assist.
You never married, he confirmed. How do you know that?
Still called Granger.
A lot of women don't change their name when they get married, Granger said. The opportunity to spar with him seemed to cheer her up.
My wife changed hers, he said.
Beatrice Lee.
B. Lee.
He smirked, embarrassed. Sounds ridiculous, I know, but she hated her father. Granger shook her head.
Nobody hates their father. Not deep down.
You can't.
He made you.
Let's not go there, said Peter. We'll end up talking about religion.
Kurtzberg's hearse was a dot on the horizon now. A sparkling constellation of rain hung right above it.
What are you going to call your kid? Asked Granger.
I don't know, he said. It's hard for me to conceive of yet.
It's a bit scary.
They say it changes you forever.
I mean, not that I don't want to be changed, but you can see what's happening to the world. You can see where things are heading.
The decision to put a child in danger like that, to expose an innocent child to God knows, goodness knows.
He faltered and fell silent. Granger appeared not to have been listening. She hopped onto the treadmill and swayed her hips like a dancer, keeping her feet still, to see if the thing would move. She jerked her pelvis. The treadmill advanced maybe a couple of centimeters.
Your kid will be brand new to the planet, she said. Your kid won't be thinking about all the things we've lost, the places that went to hell, the people who died. All that stuff will be prehistoric like the dinosaurs. Stuff that happened before time began. Only tomorrow will matter. Only today.
She smiled.
Like, what's for breakfast?
He laughed.
Are you packed? He said.
Sure. I didn't come with much. Leaving the same way.
I'm packed too.
It had been a 3-minute job. There was scarcely anything in his luggage now. Passport, keys to a house that might, by the time he got there, have a different look. Some pencil stubs. The bright yellow boots sewn by Lover 5, each stitch of which had been executed with infinite care, so as not to risk injuring her hands. A pair of trousers that fell off his hips. A few t-shirts that would hang so loose on him that he'd look like a refugee decked out in charity hand-me-downs.
Anything else?
He didn't think so. The other clothes he'd brought with him were ruined by mildew, or sacrificed as rags during the construction of his church. He knew that when he got home, it would be cold, and he'd not be able to ponce about in a dish dasher with nothing underneath, but that was a problem for another day. The weirdest absence from his rucksack was his Bible. He'd owned that Bible since his conversion. It had counseled, inspired, and comforted him for so many years, he must have thumbed its pages thousands of times. The weave of the linen-enriched paper probably contained so many cells from his fingertips that a new Peter could be grown from the DNA.
Before you came,
Jesus Lover 17 once said,
we were all alone and weak. Now, together, we are strong.
He hoped that she and her fellow Jesus lovers would derive some strength from his cherished King James, their very own Book of Strange New Things. It was all committed to memory anyway. The parts that were important, the parts he might need. Even now, he was pretty sure he could recite the Gospel of Matthew, all 28 chapters of it, except for the Ezekias begat Joatham stuff at the very start. He thought of B reading to him from chapter 6 in the bedroom of her tiny flat when they were first together. Her voice soft and fervent as she spoke of the heavenly sanctuary where precious things were safe from harm. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. He thought of Matthew's last words and the meaning they could have for two people who loved each other. I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen.
This is Josh Cohen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book of Strange New Things by Michelle Faber. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2014 by Michelle Faber. Production copyright 2014, Random House LLC. All rights reserved.